Okay, so I will talk about delay activity and its relationship with learning of associations. So first, what is delay activity? So it's known under many different names. Delay activity actually comes from the neurophysiologists. So the term delay activity comes from the neurophysiologists who perform experiments in behaving monkeys. And in these experiments, there is, when you investigate the neural basis of working memory, there is usually a delay period, as you will see later, with some interesting phenomena occurring in this delay period, in which the monkey has to hold something in memory. So it's called also persistent activity, and the name persistent comes from the fact that you can find some neurons whose activity persists at rather high levels during this period in which there is no, in absence of the stimulus that elicited that activity. It's also called sustained activity. Some experimentalists went even further and called it mnemonic activity, like Patricia Goldman-Rakic in Yale, who performed many of these experiments. The belief is that this activity is actually the neural correlate of short-term or working memory in the monkey. And theorists like to think this activity is actually comes from a kind of reverberating activity in a network, and you can interpret this as an attractive state.
So experimentalists don't like to think that this is reverberating, or the ones you are familiar with?
I think most of them are not really familiar with this. They don't. So
what do they think about?
I don't know many experimentalists who perform these kind of experiments. The only one I know, which Patricia Goldman-Rakic, I think now understand more or less the concept of attractive state. But I know no other experimentalists doing these experiments.
I took other ideas around which are
Not really, no. So this phenomenon of personal activity has become rather popular among theorists in recent years, and the focus has been mainly on experiments on prefrontal cortex, which is a part of the brain where you can see this type of activity. So here in this talk, I will rather focus on other areas where this activity is observed, which are areas in the temporal lobe, for example, IT cortex or the perirhinal cortex. And the activity in the areas is interesting because it provides some evidence of links between this type of activity and learning, and in particular, learning of associations. So the simple scenario that I will, which is actually quite an old scenario, that I will show in this talk. Some of it is rather old stuff, but part of it would be more recent. Is the following. So you will in this scenario you have stimulus presentation. So the monkey sees repetitions of images which are shown on the screen, and these stimulus presentation elicit learning in a network. Learning in turn elicits delay activity, and delay activity will be actually the vehicle which will allow for learning of associations between stimuli. So it's not anymore learning of stimuli independently of each other, but it's rather learning of associations between them. And this will in turn modify the delay activity pattern. So it's kind of feedback loop between the learning in synapses and delay activity in normal patterns. So first, this is very bad scans, but forgive me for this very bad quality. Probably many of you have probably seen these slides at least 10 times. So this is the basic phenomenon. You have here it's one cell recorded in IT cortex, and so the basic task is the delay matched to sample task. you have a presentation of one picture here, followed by a delay period in which the monkey has held in memory which image was presented here, and at the end of the delay period you have a match, and the monkey has to say whether the match was equal or not to the sample, and after that there is a reward if the monkey responds correctly. And you have some cells which respond selectively for maybe one or several of the images shown in the experiment, and furthermore they show some sustained activity afterwards, which persists all the way through the end of the delay period, which here is about 16 seconds. And so this experiment was actually the first one to provide provide evidence for links between delay activity and learning, because this particular cell is actually you can see instances of these cells in many different areas. So this was not the main the new feature of this work, but rather the new feature was to discover that when you present these images in a fixed sequence, so there were actually 100 images in this experiment, and you show them always in the same order. And then what you can plot here is the delay activity following presentation of a particular particular image as a function of its position in the sequence. And you can't see it from this scan, but believe me that these responses tend to cluster around a preferred position, and you have this kind of hills of activity, which means that a cell tend to like to be activated in a delay corresponding to a particular image, but then it also tends to like a bit less the image which are the nearest neighbors, and so on. With a distance of a few neighbors. And here you have two examples of these cells, and you see that, well, you can maybe guess that there are these clusters. And you can show that also plotting at the correlation between delay activity patterns corresponding to neighbors in the sequence as a function of the distance. And you see that these correlations are significant until a distance of about 5. Okay, this actually does not appear when you show a set of 100 images which are new to the monkey. So then if you plot the responses as a function of these 100 images, you find no clustering. Okay, so this experiment by Miyashita elicited a lot of interest at the beginning of the 90s. As I told you, so this stuff is very old, and people actually starting from Grignasti, Tsodix, and Amit built models based on the Hopfield model, and modified this model in simple ways to account for learning between nearest neighbors in a sequence, and they showed how this kind of correlations could show up in such models. So there was some kind of excitement about this, but then this a bit died away. I want to talk about more recent experiments, which I think have continued in this trend of relating delay activity with learning of associations, and I want to show how the kind of models that were used at the beginning of the 90s can be extended to reproduce these results and show some insight about what might be happening. So the next kind of task that was investigated in the experiment was the task with pair associates. So now you don't have any more sequence, you have these abstract patterns which are grouped in pairs. So these are actually uncorrelated. They have no geometrical similarities between them. They have just been arbitrarily grouped in pairs. And in the task, again, so there is a sample which is one of these pictures is shown, then a delay period, and at the end of the delay period, you show two pictures to the monkey, one of which is the pair associate, and the other one is a randomly selected image. And the monkey has to actually point the screen to the, in the direction of the Perrache machine. So it's actually a very very hard task to learn for a monkey, but eventually the monkey learns the task. It's very hard because these pictures are not really have no clear relationship between them. And the results, so again, it's recordings, so in IT cortex and IT perihymnal cortex by Sakai and Miyashita, so again in the temporal lobe. And what they found, so the first result is that the visual responses in response to the two images which are Perrache associated became correlated, and were more correlated than the visual responses between two images corresponding to two different pairs. The second result was that when you looked at in the delay period, what they found is they found cells which had, so this was a cell which was visually responsive for one image, say this one, and it exhibited some delay activity following presentation of this cell. However, if you showed as a sample now the paired associate of this cell, so it had no visual, this particular cell exhibited no visual response at all, but rather it had some kind of climbing delay activity in the delay period until presentation of the pair associate, this one, which the cell tend to like, so there is no surprise that actually there is high firing here, because it's essentially the same condition as here.
But less than
well, yeah, you're right, it tends to fire somewhat less.
So there is some difference between the image being the sample of the mesh, or?
They don't talk about this. Yeah, they did not investigate this. Well, this is another example here with this climbing activity here in the delay period. Okay. So then there was another quite interesting experiment, always in the group of Miyashita, by Naya et al. And so now it's even more complicated experiment, which becomes really hard for the monkey. It's a kind of combination of the pair associate task and the delay match to sample. So the monkey has to learn both to do the pair associate and the delay match to sample task. And actually, at the beginning of the trial, it doesn't even know what kind of task it will perform. But again, the cells are grouped into pairs, so now you can see them better, probably. And so there is a queue, and then there is a first part of the delay period where the queue disappears, but the color of the queue remains on the screen. Then, so there is equally probable outcomes here. With 50% probability, the color switches to the color of the paired associate. And this indicates to the monkey that he will be performing the pair associate task. Okay. Then the color disappears here in the third part of the delay period, and then the monkey has the choice between these two patterns, which have the same color, but only one of them is the pair associate. You see that this guy here is the correct response. In the delay match to sample task, however, so there is no color switch here. So the monkey knows that he will have to perform the delay match to sample, and so it's the classical delay match to sample.
Should the monkey have to learn many, many pairs, at least?
Here it's 12 pairs, 24. Okay. Yeah.
Can you do it?
So the learning is extremely long. It's monthly, but eventually the monkeys
learn. Yeah, only share this.
And here you can see the area where recording is done, which is part of perihymnal cortex. So the main result of this task was to find out cells which actually have different behavior depending on the task. So this particular cell, for example, so tends to like a particular picture. Here it fires at elevated rate, and it has some elevated activity in the delay period. So first, in these experiments, this might not look elevated. Actually, it's about between 5 and 10 hertz are typical delay rates for cells in this area for some reasons, which is very low. But spontaneous activity is much lower, it's about 1, 2 hertz. But then in the paired associate task, this cell, when there is the switching of colors, stop is personal activity. And it goes back to background activity. On the other hand, when when you do the DMS task, this cell goes on until the end of the DA period. On the other hand, so now you can show the paired associate of this this pattern.
So at this moment, the monkey already knows which task it is.
Yeah, at this point, the monkey, there is the color switch here, so the monkey knows that he will have to perform a paired associate task. Okay.
Okay.
So now here, he doesn't have to remember the old.
So from this point,
he
knows that he will have to point to the paired associate, not to the picture itself.
So if you have a cell which is selected for the associate, it will switch on at this moment.
Okay, so that's the next. So this is when you show actually the paired associate. So in the first part of the delay period, you don't see anything here. On the other hand, when you have the color switch, you have the elevated activity which builds up here, and this is actually the delay match to sample with the paired associate when you don't find any activity.
So one can intention and basically the switch between one attractor and the other.
Apparently yes. Okay, and then there is the last experiment, which is Morrison experiment by Eggstrom and Desimon, neural correlates of visual association learning, where they actually, what they try to do is to try to see how the correlations between activity between the delay period and either the visual presentation before or after, how this could build up during learning. And to do this, they had to devise a very simple task, much simpler than the task of Miyashita. And so the task they devised was, again, to have these pictures that they show to the monkey. And they arbitrarily, again, associate pictures in pairs, so it's paired between predictor and choice. But however, to solve the task, all the monkey has to do is to associate the choice with a go or a no-go. So to solve the task, it doesn't need to remember the predictor, actually. Okay. This should be go, this should be no-go. As you see, all the conditions, all the pairs are no-go. However, most of the times, this picture is preceded by some specific predictor. Most of the time, 85% of the time. And then you can have some other associations which are done in what they call invalid or neutral trials. So the monkeys can learn this task so if you start a recording session during one day, the monkeys can learn this task in a single day with new pairs.
Okay.
The task? Okay. So you could, the basic task is just an association between a picture and go or no-go. And you have just four of them, so the monkey should learn to associate this with go, this with no-go. And this, you can learn this in a single day. Okay. However, in the task, so you have also a kind of sample and match period, which are not. And before, there is this predictor image, which is 85% of the time predicts the correct choice.
But the monkey doesn't have to pay attention to it.
Yeah, he doesn't. The task does not require that he memorizes this.
And these are not from the same four, these are some other pictures.
Yes, exactly. So you have a separate set of predictor and choice pictures.
And there is no correlation between the predictors and the choice? If the predictor choice is goal, the predictor belongs to the group of goals. And if the predictor is the choice is no goal, the predictor belongs to the group of no goals. Predictor is
There is a correlation because 85. So this picture here, 85% of the time, predicts that there is a choice associated with a goal.
But the predictor never appears as a choice.
It never appears
as a choice. Because a choice, but it can get some information. It has some information, let's say, but not complete information about the choice. About whether it's go or no.
Yeah. But you can predict with 85% probability that it will be go. If you see that, but with still
color correlation.
No, I don't think they. it's probably not. Yes. Okay. So that's the task, and so the monkey might not be aware that there are these associations. You know. So how However, so the main results of these experiments are these Erickson and Desimond find some delay activity in the course of this experiment in perirhinal cortex, and the main result is that after one day of experiment with new stimuli, they find that delay activity is only correlated with the activity in the predictor period. Well, on the second day of experimenting with new stimuli, this delay activity becomes correlated with both predictor and choice periods. Okay. So there seems to be a first stage of learning where delay activity is mostly retrospective. It just carries on information about what was shown before. But later on, what happens is the delay activity becomes predictive, or prospective. So it carries information about what will be shown after. Okay.
This correlation is not talking because there is a passive correlation, just induced by the correlation with the predictor, but they separate that out, they factor that out.
What do you mean by passive correlation?
They appear almost always together, so how it's.
But you have also these other trials in which so you can actually do statistics using the fact that you have trials in which the predictor is actually followed by a different choice. So it's all with the discussion of the experimental data. So now I want to just mention a few things about models of first basic persistent activity models, and then investigate how these phenomena could occur using as simple as possible models. So,
let me try to understand how using the other trials you can. Say cell 5 is allowed to predictor A.
So this firing in the first day, this firing is here regardless of whether the cell or what will be next.
But
so it's the same in 85% and 15%, and then you will see the difference.
But how does the monkey know that?
No, you're right. So what happens is that the cell starts to be influenced by whether it were it was so the so actually. So let's say that you have cells which responds to the predictor, and so these cells maybe go on firing during the delay. So these are the classical retrospective cells, and then you have other cells which fire in the choice period, but these are separate subset of cells in the first day. At least that's a simple interpretation of their results. In the second day, these cells start to fire also in the delay. So the activity in the delay, in that sense, is correlated both to the predictor and to the choice. Okay.
Okay.
So at least that's a possible interpretation, and that's what we'll show up in the.
But that's in the what delay they see, or what is the interpretation?
Well, you all see graphs with values of correlation coefficients. So they don't show really the patterns.
In other words, in other words, what really matters is not so much the trial with or without the prediction, but the fact that sometimes you have a delay activity without the response to the predictor. Right?
Yeah, at least that's an interpretation of the results, at least.
But what they do, they just correlate the delay activity with the scene.
Yes, with they have like values of delay of predictor activity for the eight pictures, and then the same values for during the delay, and then the values during the C, and they correlate them. So that's all. okay, so we can choose. So what I will talk now will be just about attractors in recurrent networks, and at some point also about transition between attractor. But all I would need was just for a single neuron would be just a simple input-output relationship. And let me choose this one, which I think is nice for a couple of reasons. For the first one is very simple because the relationship between the firing and the input is either quadratic or square root, which makes calculations of stable states in the network particularly simple. It's just solving quadratic equations. And it has also some nice properties. It separates a sub-threshold region from a super-threshold region here. So in the super-threshold region, this transfer function is just a square root of the current minus the threshold. And this is actually what you expect for many single-cell models, actually all single-cell models which have sudden non-bifurcation leading to firing. On the left of this, you have the sub-threshold behavior, and this is this region. In this region, you expect that firing will be due to noise around the mean current, and you actually expect that in that region the FI curve will have some positive curvature. And one example of this is just to take a quadratic function for the FI curve. Furthermore, this function is both continuous and its derivative are continuous everywhere. So
the three parameters.
Well, so you can put, so that there is one parameter which gives the scale of the current and one which gives the scale of the firing rates. And there is this special point here, these parameters you can put to one, IC and UC.
But it doesn't respond to the amplitude of noise or something.
Yeah, but no, there is no parameters regulating the magnitude of noise here. So you just take some magnitude of noise on you. On you. Just the. A very simple thing you can do.
There would be some threshold that you can incorporate in there.
Well, you could add some arbitrary current here, translate this, and then you have some. Okay, but this is just essentially one is essentially the of the other magnitude of the neural threshold, and one here is essentially the firing rate from which the neuron goes from sub threshold to super threshold firing modes. These are essentially these, but then you have dimensionless parameters. Okay, so what is the most simple model for personal activity? Well, the most simple model is to have just purely excitatory neurons with some feedback. So then you have firing rate population mu, which gives rise to some synaptic current in the same neurons, which is proportional to j nu, and then the firing rate is just the solution of this equation, of this very simple equation. So to find the solutions of these equations, you can just plot this FI curve here, and then you can plot this right-hand side. You can rewrite this as mu equal I over j. So what happens is that you have a straight line, and as the excitatory feedback increases, you just lower the slope of it until it reaches the FI curve at some positive firing region. And okay, so here you can actually work out it fairly easy to derive the persistent activity, and you find this standard sudden node bifurcation here, where the personal activity branch appears here. You have an unstable branch here, which separates the silent state from the persistent activity. And then you can so the network can switch between the two states. With some external stimulation, so if you increase the external input starting from a silent point, at some point you have to jump to the upper state, and then hyperpolarizing the network, you can switch back to the silent state. So these values are actually different values of the from j equals 0, 0.5, and 1. Okay. And actually you start, so these branches here go to crosses the axis at value of which is square root of 3 over 2. Which is
finally, numbers, what is the meaning of these numbers? I mean, the scale.
So the scale, again, so one here is, again, is the point at which the firing, because it's, you go from the sub-threshold to the supra-threshold firing modes. So you can imagine the firing rate where the norm is very close to threshold. That's
so you can try to bring down the...
Well, you can take any neuronal model you like and then compute, put some noise and then compute that value for that.
But I think for real parameters, it comes in a few hertz, right?
I mean, well, so there is one example where you can actually compute the FI curve in presence of noise, which is the integrated fire norm, and then it depends on the magnitude of noise, but typically this value would be between maybe 10 and 20 hertz.
Yeah, but if you assume that neurons are spontaneously at threshold, this will become a spontaneous firing rate, and then everything is diminished. If you assume that spontaneously neurons are right at threshold.
Yes.
So then one is the level of the spontaneous firing.
Yes.
Yes.
So that's how you can compare everything to the spontaneous.
But it's a very strong assumption, because you might as well say that spontaneous in there.
Well, I say if you assume, yeah. Nobody knows.
No.
Even below, since it's quadratic.
But some people say that neurons are right at threshold spontaneous.
Yeah. And what is this view?
Well, because if you inject current, let's say, and plot the FI curve in vivo, and if you extrapolate it, it starts right at zero. So it appears like...
Well, I'll show you later using a more realistic model how you can adjust this background
right,
activity.
Without, so you don't see this convex.
With current injection in vivo?
Yeah, I think Rodney Douglas did this experiment. You try to measure FI curve in vivo.
Yeah.
So you can only do it for high enough currents because of the noise. But if you then extrapolate, it looks like it goes to zero and you don't see
but
any.
How can you extrapolate if you just measure here? How can you extrapolate in that picture?
Well, if you just try to continue it goes to zero.
How do you know what's zero current?
Well, of course. I mean,
how do you know what's zero current?
I mean, you have to measure that in this area too.
But how do you know no one else is injecting the current?
No, that's exactly the point. So the conclusion was that someone else injects the current so that the neuron is exactly at threshold.
But actually there is some recent data, some intracellular recordings in visual cortex. I think there is some paper by Förster where you can see something like this actually, which when they plot how the firing rate of the cell depends on the holding membrane potential, which is different, but I think it would be quite similar to this, and you can see clearly a region like this. So, okay. Now we can use a more realistic model. So the first model that I showed was extremely simplistic, and now we can try to see how this picture holds in a more realistic picture when you have a cortical module, let's say, of excitation and inhibition. So it's the standard module, and we would like to have background activity actually, as you mentioned. And so the first problem is actually how do you stabilize background activity in such a recurrent network, and know that there is a simple solution to that, which is to have networks which are dominated by recurrent inhibition and with a strong background external inputs, which can be due to the background activity in the rest of the brain. And so now the picture, as you plot the firing rate of the network as a function of the external input, you will have, instead of the previous network where the recurrence tended to increase the rates, now the recurrence tends to decrease it because it's dominated by inhibition. And you get this curve, which is the network FI curve, if you will.
This firing rate of which neuron?
Of all neurons, you can say that all of them are equivalent, for example, in the sequence case. And you send external inputs to everybody.
Why is it equal? Because you make a symmetric connection.
Yes.
Why did you get smoothly to zero in terms of external input?
Here? Well, why not? No, it's, in some cases, actually, it's a very simple picture. In so if you do more. So here, for example, the magnitude of the noise does not depend in a self-consistent way on the on network activity, because we just take this FIK with some kind of fixed noise magnitude. If you take into account that the fact that the magnitude of noise depends itself on network activity, then you can have more complicated pictures where you can have actually where you can have things which does not go smoothly to zero like this.
So there is no bistability in this.
Yeah, here there is no bistability. In the when you actually you cannot see any bistability when you increase external inputs like this. So how can you elicit personal activity in such network? Well, there is a solution which is again very old, would be to put some structure in the excitatory recurrence, and to, for example, you can imagine that there are some subpopulations of excitatory neurons which are each of them is responsive to a particular picture. So you have several pictures, some neurons respond to A, other to picture B, and so on. And then you add on top on the background synaptic value, you add some kind of structured synaptic matrix, which here is nothing else but the old Wilshaw matrix applied to such a recurrent network. So what you have is you have strong connections, JE plus JS, inside populations, and then you have weaker connections in between populations. So it's kind of standard associative memory model, but in the region where the number of stored patterns is rather small, so it would be far from capacity.
The initial pattern is kind of random. So do you have randomness?
So here I'll take the very simplest picture when it's actually I return the limit when f goes to zero. So these patterns you can assume that as they are non-overlapping. So these populations will be essentially non-overlapping.
So where do you store patterns? Is in A, B, C separately or between them or?
So the patterns are non-overlapping. So this one pattern is just these neurons active and all the others.
So the pattern is A is active and all that kind of window takes off?
It's just A active at high rates and these guys active at spontaneous rate. It's one pattern. Another pattern is B active at high rates and the other active at spontaneous rate.
It's
and
so on. All the neurons which belong to one pattern to one unit.
Yeah.
Okay. You assume they don't overlap.
But the standard associative memory model is if you take a finite number of patterns and you go to the limit f going to zero, they will reduce to that. It's a kind of sparse coding limit.
And it is symmetric between them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I just shown just a few of them, but
A to B and B to A is the same.
Yes.
Even by this formula.
Exactly. So this formula is actually you have a single parameter defining the synaptic matrix, which is JS, and this kind of depression term here is just put in order to ensure that the average synaptic strength and the average background activity will remain equal to GE.
F is just 1/n. One
over number. All of the P, yeah, where P is the number of patterns.
P is the number of these letters.
Right. Okay, so I have shown you this as a kind of specially clustered segregated populations, but actually, so which is one kind of possible scenario for these populations, but another scenario is just to have no special segregation at all. So here the different patterns are different colors, the neurons have just no clustering at all, but these connections arise due to learning. So here you have these different patterns and the collections form preferentially due to learning. So I have already defined all the parameters. P is some much less than N.
N over
nonce. Yeah, here it's, yeah.
In the previous picture, the number of neurons would be arbitrary because you just clump.
Yes.
What matters exactly. Is the number of patterns. It doesn't matter how many.
Okay, so again, you can do this. So now we want to investigate the delay activity patterns in that network. And so now the delay activity patterns is just one subpopulation active and all others at rest. Now, the difference with the previous picture is that we have some background activity, which is some point here. So here we have, we put some background activity at, let's say, 0.25. And so in the sparse coding, limit, when f goes to zero, you find, again, very simple equations for defining the activity in the persistent state. And now it's and it's again intersection between the single cell Fi curve and the straight line whose slope increases when you increase the parameter JS, which defines structure. So it's very similar pictures, instead that now your straight line is fixed here, but you find similar a similar bifurcation scenario here. So here the black line was the case when the background activity was equal to zero in the purely excitatory network. And now if you increase background activity, what happens is that you advance the bifurcation here, you decrease the lowest persistent activity that you can reach. And actually you can see that very easily by playing around with this. You can see that as you increase persistent activity, you are able to have an intersection here closer to that point here, which separates the two regions. So that as you increase background activity, the lowest persistent activity also decreases to one. So, and here there is a kind of special point here. But of course, there is a price of having background and persistent activity close together, is that the range of coexistence between the background activity state and the persistent activity state becomes smaller and smaller.
And finally, presumably, you get a cast in which case,
yes,
too.
Right, and you see that here. This is kind of phase diagram, if you will. So here is background activity, and here is this synaptic structure parameter, and you can see these regions where you have your only background activity. Here you have coexistence between the two, and here the background activity disappears. Okay, so now there is kind of important difference between this type of network and the previous network, which was purely excitatory.
Somehow this, the lines depend on P.
Yes, right, I'll show that later. Actually, so here we cannot really investigate this because we are in the sparse coding limit, but if you, because P is 1 over F, and F goes to 0. So, but later I will show.
How come it dropped out of the equation?
So P is not anymore in the equation because of the sparse coding limit there. But I'll show
the limit of
F goes to, yeah, F going to zero, P going to infinity, with F P equal 1 actually. So but it's the same if you take F P equal some constant. So it's, but I'll show later what happens with the finite F. But the picture is essentially the same. Now you can see. Plot again what happens when you change the external inputs to the whole network. And so we have seen that we have this branch, which is the background activity, which is a kind of network Fi curve, if you will, which is decreased compared to the single cell Fi curve. So now what happens is when you increase this JS, you form these branches here, which grow as JS increases. And the surprising phenomenon here is that persistent activity branch is no longer monotonously increasing with external inputs, but rather you have an increasing part, and then you reach a maximum.
I'm confused. What are these curves?
So here is if you start from this curve here. So this is how background activity changes with external inputs. So this is not surprising; just increases. Now these curves, let's take just the red one, which is for maybe J equal one, JS. So this is how persistent activity changes when you change the external inputs to the whole network. And surprisingly, so there is a rising phase and a decreasing
is
phase.
Is because of inhibition?
So this is actually not because of inhibition, because if I can go back to this picture here. So actually, in that picture, inhibition plays no role whatsoever in the stabilization of persistent activity. And this is due to the fact that we are in the sparse coding limit. So actually, what happens is that the subpopulation of cells, which is active, is so small that it doesn't influence any other population in the network. So the fact that you get persistent activity is due purely to the shape of this
of this
Fi curve.
So the inhibitory neuron that you showed in the picture actually doesn't enter into this equation in this limit.
Yeah, exactly. And so what happens, so why is there this decrease in, so it's kind of a surprising effect, but actually you can see that it's actually rather hard to see on this picture, but what happens is that the external inputs, the only way in which the external inputs enter this picture is that they change the spontaneous activity and the spontaneous currents here. So what happens is that you're moving this point up along this line, okay? So as you're moving up, but the slope of this curve remains unchanged. So what happens is that there is some regime in which when you increase, when this point goes up, this intersection will go up like this. And at some point when you actually, which is this region here, when you actually, so you go again in that direction so that the this upper intersection will actually go down as you increase.
The slope doesn't change. The red curve is...
The slope doesn't change because you leave JS
right,
fixed.
Right. So curves will shift to the right?
So the red curve, so here it's too thick to see anything. Yes, right. So, but what happens is that, maybe you can see that, let's imagine you go up like this. So the red curve is tied to that point as it goes up, but the slope remains constant. So when you go in that direction, this intersection goes also up. However, when you move up again here, what happens is that the red curve, the red goes again in that direction, it goes back. Okay, and this can be seen because this point at some point has to as you increase the input current, the spontaneous, the external inputs enough, then this point will have reached here. And at this point, the intersection is again here. Did you see that?
What don't you do just shift the slope of the red curve?
No, the slope is fixed.
So what do you shift?
I shift the intersection between this point.
You take the red curve to the left, to the right?
It goes to the right and it goes straight back.
It goes first to the right and then it goes again to the left.
If you draw it on that.
Yeah, I will try to. I'll try to exaggerate this. Okay. So you move this point here. So let's say here.
Because which curve you move? Do you move
you move this point. Curve? This is the point which is background activity, which defines background activity. Okay. So this is actually what you do when you apply some external inputs to the network. So this point moves up here, and so the curve, which means that in the first stage, this personal activity goes up. Okay. Then you go up, and then
you go back,
and at some point when you arrive here, the curve has gone back to its original position. Okay.
So you move along the unstable branch in a sense.
Yes, right. Actually, the point where it starts to change, when it starts to go up, is when the background activity becomes unstable. Exactly. And you can see that on the. So here, that point here is actually the point where the instable branch reaches the spontaneous activity. So here you have actually a transcritical bifurcation. So this exchange stability, this becomes unstable. So this picture actually holds in much more complicated networks because this is an example now with when you have some finite F, you have very complicated midfield equations. This is a network with integrated fire neurons and with some complicated synapses. And you can see that there is a difference, though, is that here, these kind of closed curves, which are the personal activity branches, emerged from that point and go. Here, these curves emerge from a point which is above background activity. But here, you get these closed branches, which are called the isolas. But the main point is that you have this non-monotonous behavior, which is kind of unexpected as a function of external drive. And this actually means, so this makes a big difference with respect to the previous network, which was purely only excitatory neurons. And it means that any change of global excitability of the network should have this result, which is this consequence. And
so this is a finite F case?
Yeah, this is a finite, this F equals 0.1, something like this.
but still no overlap.
Still no overlap.
Because it seems to me, I mean, there are many things that are probably crucial ingredients here, but it seems to me that one crucial ingredient is that your units that are active all receive the same drive, right? There are those in the background and those in the foreground. If you had a scatter of values for this,
I don't think this would change much.
Think so? Because here, what determines the slope?
The slope is purely this this parameter, which this structure parameter. So you can call it a learning parameter, as we will see later. But this is purely determined by this.
Strength of the memory, right? Strength of the memory.
Yeah, yeah, right. So I just want to mention also that there is one known example of manipulating persistent activity through some pharmacological means, which was actually done by Goldman Rakic in her lab, where she injected agonists.
The neural drive, which is uniform to all of the
Yes,
right.
So she injected some agonists and antagonists of the dopamine receptor D1 in an area of prefrontal cortex where persistent activity is shown. And actually, what was shown is that both agonists and antagonists at some doses would provoke a decrease in persistent activity. And actually, this also is consistent with the picture that both dopamine agonists and antagonists would be detrimental to working memory. So, just so want to mention it.
If you don't apply either agonist or antagonist, you are at the top of the.
So yeah, that's the idea. Yeah.
And this thing are simulations.
Yeah, right. Yeah. These points here. Simulations. Okay, so that's the question about how P changes on F. So here P is changed. P is 1/F, so it's not changed independently. But so the picture is that so this is the F equals 0 limit, and the same network you can take F to be 0.5 here, and you would get that this persistent activity branch is only slightly moved compared to the F equals 0 limit. So now these other curves are other types of states in which now several patterns are active contemporaneously in persistent activity. For example, you can investigate whether states with two populations are active contemporaneously, and this would have exactly the same fine rate as the one pattern state in the sparse coding limit, because again this inhibition plays no role in stabilizing that pattern. But however, in the finite F case, then inhibition plays a role, and there is actually a penalty of having more than one pattern active contemporaneously, and so these curves are displaced toward the right. So you have states with two patterns, 3, 4, and so on, which are active at the same time. Okay, so now finally move to the case of pair associated states. So we can investigate in these networks questions related to associations between states. And now what we have is we group patterns in pairs, AA prime, BB prime, and we have again these connections which I just call them J0 and G1 to be shorter. And there is a connection here between paired. We assume that there was some kind of learning between paired associates, so that the connection between pairs was strengthened with some parameter A, which is between 0 and 1, represents the strength of pair learning. And now we can start from a point where, in absence of pair learning, we have background and persistent activity, and investigate what happens when we change this pair learning parameter. So now we see that there are two types of states that you have in such networks. So the first one just grows continuously from the A equals 0 case. What happens is that you have, let's say, red is A, green is A prime. So the activity of A prime starts to increase just because of this, of the etc. feedback U to the parameter A. But however, so this is a kind of pattern where A is highly activated and A prime has low activity. And this is actually the pattern that you would see in that curve, which represents this paired associate task. So it's a kind of picture showing network activity versus time when you show picture A in that interval and A prime in that interval. So you see that first you reach that state here where A prime is activated slightly above background activity. However, there is another state which is accessible. It's a state in which both patterns are active at the same time and they are with the same rates. And there is actually, these states coexist. So you can reach the other state by presenting A prime. So you have actually bistability between these two types of states, where one weakly correlated and one strongly correlated state. And one other comment to make about this picture, so we can see now how the learning scenario using delay activity will be possible, and how these connections, which are parameterized by A, will be formed. This learning will take place because you have, due to delay activity now, you have some some overlap of high activities of the neurons which are active, which are responsive for A and for A prime in that window, even when A equals zero. So this will make possible the learning of connections, which will become stronger and stronger, leading to that picture. Okay, so we can also investigate in that simple framework how we can switch from one state to another, and we can implement the idea of Naya and et al. In that network. And so in order to model the color switch in that experiment, we can imagine that there is some kind of biased input which represent color in that experiment. So you can so that at some point you put some input to half of the pattern. So here there's maybe a picture missing. You have some pairs A prime, B prime, and all these patterns have some color, let's say red, and this is blue. So at some point in the delay period, you put some weak. So first in the first you show picture A, and at some point in the delay period you put some input corresponding to blue, which means that you put a weak biased input to all these neurons. Okay. So half of the neurons of the network receive this bias input. And, well, many things can occur depending on the strength of this biased input and the strength of this pair learning parameter. You have one region where nothing happens, you stay in the A pattern. Here in this region you destabilize the A pattern, so you go away, you go back to background activity. But there is some region here where you can actually make a switch from one to the other. And the reason is simple, is just because this, of course, is favored. It has an advantage in the competition between these because it receives some enhanced feedback from A. So this is what this picture shows. And you can switch from one pair associate to the other. Okay, so this picture is actually very similar to the picture of the old Miyashita experiment with sequences, which was investigated almost 10 years ago now, but I just want to show it for completeness. So in the case of sequences, you have these populations which now the stimuli are ordered in a sequence, and you have very strong connection inside populations and somewhat intermediate connection between nearest neighbors and weaker connections between all the other guys. So again, you can investigate when you increase the strength of these connections. So you have this pair learning parameter A. Well, it's not really more pair learning, but and again, you find this different types of state. One state in which the nearest neighbor would be weakly activated. Here, the green are the activity of these guys when you in the delay showing presentation of this guy, and this is kind of weakly activated neighbor. But then you jump. There is a transition here, and there is actually coexistence between two types of states. in a state in which these guys would be quite strongly activated with activity almost comparable to this one. And if you go, if you increase further the Perlonian parameter, you would have a series of transitions with more and more neighbors become active. And if you have also actually stable states which are not shown in this picture, which would overlap here, in which only two patterns are active, and the activity of these two is symmetrical, and this two is lower. So you can have any number of highly activated states, depending on the value of A, and you have multi-stability between them. Okay, so now this was all the very simple mean field with a very simple neuronal model. Of course, in a real network, so you have finite set effects, which actually are similar to noise, and of course, all of these states will not have an infinite lifetime. They will not be truly stable, but rather they will have some lifetime. So, in the case of the simple of the simplest network in which you have no association stored, what happens is that your personal activity will have at some point decay away, and this means that if you average over, so if you're in a region which is close to the bifurcation, you would have if you average over many trials, what you would see if you average activity in the delay period, which is some decreasing activity like this. Then another effect is that when you have learning of associations, and you have this region where these weakly correlated pair state and the strongly correlated pair state are coexist in phase space. So you can make transition between them. And if you're close to the bifurcation, you can have this situation in which the transitions during the delay period are essentially happen at random times. And if you do an average of many trials, you would have this smoothly increasing firing rate, which actually seem to correspond to what you see in the experiments, for example, by Sakai and Yashida. Okay, so now this was all with fixed synapses. What about learning process? How can we reach these synapses? The goal here is to look at the simplest possible scenario, and the simplest scenario would be to have just a two-state synapse, so you have just a low and high state, and you can do probabilistic transitions between between the two states. And these are, so the transition towards the high state would be an LTP-like transition, and towards the down state, LTD-like. Now, of course, the probability of transition has to depend on the pre- and post-synaptic firing rate in order to learn something in that firing rate. So this is old-fashioned Hebbian learning, and you can plot what will happen in the plane pre-synaptic, post-synaptic firing rate. And we just choose a very, very simple kind of learning table where you have strong LTP when you have coexistence of when you have high rates, presynaptic and postsynaptic. You have weaker LTP in this region, and you have LTD when there is high presynaptic, like low postsynaptic rate in that region too. So what will happen now is that in absence of external inputs,
we can debase also on the...
Yeah, it should be here. I don't know where it... It does not appear. So this is completely symmetrical with respect to the diagonal. Oh, okay. Maybe I should stop actually. I don't know. It's time. I think I have just a few slides. So the.
There's no rush.
So in absence of stimulations, the network is just. All the synapses on the network are these regions, so nothing happens. Okay, this is a kind of requirement for stability of this scheme. Otherwise, if something happens in absence of external stimulation, then then all kinds of instabilities will occur. And even when there is persistent activity, so what happens is that these synapses between neurons will be maybe in this area, but nothing will happen. Then when you have visual presentations, so some neurons have high visual response, and connections between such neurons will be strengthened because we'll go to this area here. Okay? And going to this going to this area means that you will enhance this parameter JS that I mentioned
so
before.
So this is the language you draw. This is your model of relativity.
Yeah, right. This is a possible model which will reach the desired synaptic matrices.
Okay.
Okay. It's a kind of discrete version of if you make a cut, for example, in this line, it would be kind of discretized version of the Binance-Stoke-Cooper model, mm-hmm. something like this.
But with no adjustment of threshold.
No. Yeah, with fixed threshold. Then what you will form delay activity by the strengthening of connections due to the LTP in this area. Okay, and you have also LTD occurring because some neurons are here actually during visual presentations. Now what happens is that when you form delay activity, when you show subsequently a pattern after, so you show a second pattern, so these neurons which are here, they start going down. So for example, a presynaptic neuron with, So the neurons which are in let's look at one pair of neurons, one of which is in this persistent activity state, and another one which sees some visual presentation. So these neurons now, the neuron postsynaptic neuron is some visual presentation, so its rate goes here, while the delay neuron, its rate is slowly decaying toward the background activity. So it's in this region where weak LTP occur, and that's why you create some finite A in this. So you can actually simulate one of these training sessions that experimentalists do with monkeys. So here it's a particular case where probability of high LTB is 0.05, of low LTD is 0.002, and of low LTP and low LTD is 0.05. So you see that these red lines here indicate visual presentation of one particular pattern. So here there are maybe 20 patterns organized in pairs, and you show them randomly. So this indicates presentation of one particular pattern, and that the red dots, the green dots, indicate the delay activity following presentation of one pattern. And you see that at some point here, after some amount of presentation, you stabilized delay activity, and this correlates with the fact that the synapse. Here in this plot, we plot the average strength of the synapse of neurons inside that population, which became close to one here. So up to that point, you're essentially moving, you're just changing one parameter JS in the previous pictures. But then since delay activity appeared, now you start also forming connections between the pairs. And this is shown by this green line here. And the parameters are actually chosen between the weak LTP and LTD. There is some kind of balance that you need to achieve between the two so that this parameter remains small, that you don't always end up in the symmetrical attractor. And then you start to activate the pair associate in the delay pair, this is shown by the blue line, and then you reach also the symmetrical attractor after the presentation of the second synapse. Okay. So this was with the previous simple.
You can say how many presentations you need.
So this depends on the rate of these probabilities, LTP, LTD.
But you can now adjust them to.
You can adjust them.
You have an idea of how. Because you know how long it takes for the monkey to learn.
Yes, right. So in the picture that I showed before, so it's actually you could learn associations in one single because the training the experiments with monkeys usually are the order of 500 presentations in one day. So this simulated actually a training day, and you could learn associations in one day. But if you slow down all the probabilities by a factor of two, then you divide them out by two, then you will have learned in 2 days, which actually is what happens
with
the
experiment. With any probability, at some point
you reach. Well, if you scale all the probabilities in the same way, of course, if you change the balance between them, then you will not necessarily reach these kind of states. So essentially, the priorities of this weak LTP, the balance between weak LTP and LTD is kind of crucial to reach the right regime, a kind of sensitive parameter, which could actually be adjusted by some metaplasticity scenarios, but which are not at all here. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is now simulations with integrated fire neurons. Unfortunately, we don't really see what happens here, but just what happens here is that you can see these transitions to the symmetrical attractor, which occur at some random times. No, you can't really see them, but and then when you average, you see this smoothly increasing delay activity here. And so now we have a scenario in which, so what happens is that we don't have a scenario in which what happens in the delay activity is purely a very fast reaching of an attractor and then some stable patterns goes on. Now, you can imagine that many kinds of transitions can occur in the delay period. And so you have these temporal patterns which are more interesting than these fixed patterns. So for example, this is a simulation of the Miyashita experiment with sequences where you see that you have presentation of one pattern here, but now due to this multi-stability between these different patterns, you see that the network immediately jumps to a two-state delay activity pattern and then wanders around in phase space and make these random transitions back and forth here. And actually, so what happens is that when you average over the delay period, what happens is that you don't have these pictures of all these transitions, but you have a kind of average picture where you can see this broad activation of populations over the whole delay period. But actually, if you would put the instantaneous activation of the network, you would have a much more narrowly concentrated activity pattern. Okay. And then I want to mention, so most of this work has been done so either in collaboration with Daniel Amit or was born in discussions with him. Okay.